Hello and welcome to the first live Tech Weekly recording coming to you in front of an audience of hundreds, no, thousands of people here at this year's DigiFest Festival of Science and Technology at the Science Museum's Dana Center in London. Welcome, one and all. That is what I'm talking about. Thank you very much. It is a real pleasure for us to be here today. It's an experiment of sorts to see if we, the Guardian podcast team, can confidently leave the safety blanket that envelops us and Guardian Towers at King's Cross and take our technology message to the masses. Thus far, there have been no tomatoes thrown at the stage, but we do have a bumper 30 minutes to fill, and the night is still young. So if you do hear a telltale squish on the microphone throughout the course of this week's edition, well, you'll know what's happened. On this week's program, we've invited some very special guests to look at two sides of the same coin. We're talking about our digital rights, from information that's censored by governments to information that's collected about us every time we go online. We'll be welcoming the Censorship Research Center's head honcho, Austin Heap. He's the wunderkid hacker whose Haystack software provided the conduit for many Iranian protesters to communicate about what was happening on the ground in the 2009 Iranian elections. We'll also be speaking with Christina Zaba, freelance journalist and author, editor and activist, specializing in privacy issues, who also teaches at Bristol University. We'll be detailing the information that's collected about us every time we browse the web, and we'll be offering her advice on how to avoid getting your digital dossier on a database. Joining me on the stage is Guardian technology editor Charles Arthur, no stranger to this podcast, and Becky Hogg, writer at The Guardian and New Statesman, technologist and former executive director of the Open Rights Group. So let's give it up for Becky. Welcome to you both. Now, Becky, the theme of this week's program is digital rights. It's an area that you've followed as a technology journalist and as an activist for quite a long time. How did you develop your interest in documenting this space?
So I think it was an accident of timing. I got online at the end of the 90s. And when I did, what I found there made me really enthusiastic.
Charles, you've been a passionate proponent of open data, most notably in the Free Our Data campaign at The Guardian. How do digital rights play a role in the Free Our Data campaign and this open data movement?
Well, the whole idea of Free Our Data came out of the simple calculation that, in effect, we're the citizens. We own the government because we fund the government. And if government owns agencies and companies such as Ordnance Survey, then actually the things that Ordnance Survey does should surely belong to us.
Well, we'll explore some of that, I'm sure, when we're talking about censorship, because there are clearly governments out there who don't want to offer up their data and certainly even access to the information that's on the web. Now, all of tonight's themes and most of the questions have come from our audience here in the Dana Center via email and via Twitter before the event and also during too. So stick around for our first live Tech Weekly recording, and please, please don't throw vegetables unless they're soft. Every day, every time we surf the web, with every click, we're giving up information about ourselves. Now, this is an issue that actually fascinates me profoundly because there's so much misunderstanding about the issues. Recently, when I tackled the subject for the BBC Two series, The Virtual Revolution, the reaction that we received to this particular program was vastly polarized to an extent that I really didn't expect. First of all, the geeks, you know, my mates, were really quite irritated that we were fear-mongering, as they put it, that we were creating headlines about the amount of data that was collected about us by organizations like Google and Amazon when we do a search or when we purchase a product. And they suggested that we overinflated the issues, which were already well known, which were well understood, and well under control. It was a trade, they said, that they were happy to make because of the benefits that of the services that they received outweighed any of the potential risks. Now, on the other hand, there was an enormous response from, well, non-geeks who had watched the film, who literally, in their hundreds, told me that they had no idea that the information that they typed into search engines or that they used to buy things on Amazon was collated and used by companies to make money. They didn't realize that the extent of what information about themselves they gave to the online services that they used created such a well-rounded and non-anonymous picture of themselves. And so I think that this topic seems ripe for debate. What are the public and private issues? Who is collecting the data? What are they doing with it? How secure is it? How much control might we have over our personal data as we surf the extraordinary resource that is the World Wide Web? Joining us on stage is Christina Zaba from privacy campaigners No2ID, an organization that's most notably outspoken against UK national identity cards. But also, Christina has a voice in the online privacy and the digital rights debate. Christina, what kinds of information is collected about us when we use the web?
Every click you make on a computer is recorded by something somewhere, or can be, or, you know, it's potentially kept forever. So if you, for example, go and order an airline ticket, there's no guarantee that that information is ever going to be taken away. In fact, there are lots of ways in which it empowers and helps commercial organizations to keep the data, and they swap the data around, don't they, and give it to each other so that you can, for example, be targeted with different advertising. And Facebook is a prime example of this. They're making billions, aren't they, because millions of people are on Facebook giving their preferences and giving their personalities, and then, of course, the advertising can be targeted.
Why is this a problem? And the reason I ask this is because snooping already exists offline, right?
Yeah.
We've already got quite a lot, especially in this country, we've got a lot of surveillance that happens. And Alex Turner asked us earlier on Twitter. He says, online privacy is meaningless in the face of GCHQ and the NSA. Isn't it better for people to realize this and assume snooping?
Well, I think that's a wise thing to assume. But the problem is, we haven't agreed to it. I haven't agreed that the government can tell what I'm doing, where I'm going, who I'm talking to, what about. I haven't agreed to any of that. And there has been legislation enacted in Britain and elsewhere in the world to allow governments to do certain things, to watch our, for example, our email traffic, who we're sending what to whom. And the thing is that when it's just me in my little box, who cares? But when it's me and you and them amplified by 60 million, that becomes an enormously powerful tool to track where people are going and what they're doing.
Isn't that sort of part of the social contract, the sort of the way that we mix in with each other, that we're able to rub along and that we sort of make these accommodations with each other, that, okay, well, you know a bit about me, and I sort of tell my council where I live so that they can charge me a council tax, which means that therefore they provide services to me. And the other thing is about the government collecting all this data, which, okay, it's sort of true, but at the same time, we seem to have this, we seem to hold sort of these two conflicting viewpoints, which is that, governments are really bad because they collect loads and loads of data about us. And on the other hand, we're saying, you know, governments are really rubbish at IT projects. We seem at the same time to have these conflicting ideas that governments are collecting lots of data about us, and yet we don't think they can do anything useful. And one tends to think that actually the cock-up sort of process is more likely, that they're actually going to be less effective at doing anything with this data, and that they're actually going to be drowning in a sea of data rather than swimming through it.
I mean, if you build one of these large databases and you grant access to, say, even 100, let alone 1,000 civil servants, then you're going to lose out on, I think, fundamentally, you're going to lose out on one axis. Either it's going to be security or it's going to be accuracy. You know, you can't build these large data sets and then fling them out to other people. Just because of the human factor, the corruption factor, there will be one bent civil servant who will be earning money on the side selling data to private investigators. We've seen stories like that already emerging. So there is this issue of trust and also of the feasibility of building those kind of databases. If you're granting access, then it's the human factor comes into play.
There are things, Christina, that yeah, we willingly give up, and we actually are complicit in this, are we
oh,
not?
Of course, yeah. We willingly give them up, but we also don't quite understand how long they can last and what can be done with them. But yeah, okay, I take Charles's point. There is a contract. You know, if you're going to some kind of a commercial site, then you're giving something, you're actually typing in your thing, and that's okay. But what about the further level of aggregation of data that you're not aware of? And particularly, I'm thinking of the actual, you know, deliberate kinds of schemes that the UK and other governments are putting together now and are in fact building, which collect all sorts of data that people have to give in order to supposedly, for example, access services that they don't imagine will be kept forever. We've got the summary care record going ahead now in this country, where the health service wants to get everybody on computer. Actually, the option of opting out is quite difficult. And most people, by default, will end up on this thing. And they don't really know what's going to be done with that, whether it'll be used for research. Does it matter?
I'd really actually love to hear from Christina where she thinks the models are for privacy in the digital age, because I think that's maybe what holds back this debate. You know, I like the idea of, do we trust the government more than we trust corporations? I mean, if we kind of go down that road, we're just going to get into an ideological debate where we all disagree about the things we always disagree about. But is there a model for privacy that will actually work digitally? I'd really love to hear about that.
Well, I'd like to have ownership of personal data and control over personal data. So any time you give your data to somebody, you should. It must be possible to make it controllable, and it must be possible to make it still within my power.
That's a really strange idea. That means that every email you send, which has a sort of bit of personal data, which is your email address, you want to be able to say, actually, no, I didn't want to send that email to you.
No, you can't pull it back. You can't pull it back, but it's still yours. Can we not somehow keep a thread that goes on it so that we know what's happening to it and so that it's owned?
Yeah, I'd like to throw that out. Would anybody like to propose a solution? Go on.
Hello, my name's Glyn, and I come from a startup. And the email one, if you're technically aware, is already quite possible to do this in that you allocate yourself different emails which you give out to different people. And so if someone then passes that email address on to spammers, you just stop using that email address. So, I mean, Google allows this already with some of its services in that you can have your name plus some extra letters you append on the end of it. So people do already do this in the area with email. Similar things are done with private data where you have different profiles, and every time they want to find out what your address is, instead of storing it on their database, they poll the service and say, please, what's your address now? Every time the government wants to write to you, they poll this service and says, hello, what's your address?
But doesn't that then have the weakness that we continue here, which is, oh my God, you've got a single point of failure. Everyone's data sits in this big stack, and all the hacker has to do is to get into there, and they're straight up and down like a rat up a drainpipe.
Yes and no. It depends if all the data is stored in one place.
The tips and tricks that you're describing are those that are known in a certain technologically minded point, you know, a group of people. My mum wouldn't know that, and nor would she necessarily enact that. And similarly, there are other technologies. The one that springs to mind is Tor,
yes,
which is a personal anonymizing technology. Tor is not doing very well at all. You know, people aren't jumping on the Tor bandwagon. Surely people would say, wow, well, I want something that turns me into a cloak that surrounds me and that I can't be tracked.
Well, yes, but, you know, where's the publicity? I think with, you know, your mum or mine, or the other people who don't really understand anything about it, how do they get to it? How do they do it? Where is it?
I think that the whole thing about online privacy is just an extension of the fact that we don't quite know what is private and what isn't anymore in the real physical world.
But most people do have a front door. Nobody is arguing that we shouldn't have front doors with keys. And we have a whole range of legislative and indeed intuitive and citizenly habits, really, that have grown up over centuries around that, around what belongs to whom, what's the property. The digital age is terribly new. We've only had it 20 years. In fact, you know, in living memory, you know, in terms of understanding the ethics behind it and in terms of understanding where I and you begin and end, none of that's been defined. And what's making it worse is that it's moving all the time. It's moving constantly.
This is a very, very impassioned debate, and I knew that this would stimulate lots and lots of questions. I'd like to first go to the gentleman in the blue.
Sorry, my name's Tim Hodges. I work for a computer games company. You guys sort of started to dwell towards this issue of maybe educating people is more important. You talked about, like, grandparents not knowing what it is, but I didn't really stick with it, and I wasn't sure if that was because you don't see education as being a vital component, or if you think there should be something in place before education becomes a component of telling people about, you know, how their data is being used and making them aware and ensuring that, you know, lawyers can't get involved in quite the same way with making everything so, you know, legal.
Well, is it practical to educate everybody so quickly in this? I'd love to see it, you know. I'd love to see that happen. I'd love the entire world to be empowered. I think it can be done through the mechanisms that we have, but I think there needs to be will to do it. And who's going to educate? Who's going to do the educating?
Yes, I'd like to go to this gentleman here.
Yes, my name's Scott, and I used to work for one of these rather large software companies that collects this information. I've seen one of these search engines in action, and the data is staggering. I think the main concern that people should have is more access and sharing. I think the collection is just, forget it, it's done, it's gone. There's so much out there. But I think the main concern is more the sharing of your data with organisations that could do something that you don't particularly want.
I'd like to just pull in a couple of comments here before we go to the next question. Brian O'Farrell, you say that you disagree with Christina that targeted advertising is great.
Most spam is often about P&L enhancements, Viagra, all the things. So any targeted advertising which doesn't see you getting targeted with fitness drugs, increased targeted advertising is a good thing because it sees you getting advertised items which you're more interested in. So Amazon records what books and DVDs you've looked at as well as what you've purchased and makes suggestions.
So these are great examples of how data collection and data privacy can be used for benefit. But in the meantime, many thanks to Christina and to our audience for a stimulating debate. You can find all the links to all the services that we talked about on our website, guardian.co.uk/techweekly, where you can also continue this debate. Audience, it's over to you. At this point, it feels like we've done enough talking, so we'd like to hear what you think about a few of the subjects that we've covered on the program recently. If you'd like to make a point or ask a question of the panel, then do raise your hand and we'll pass a mic over to you. First, the two main political parties have laid out their technology manifestos recently. Charles, you've read them, Labour and Conservative. What's in them?
Lots of promises, not much in the way of solid ideas about what would happen. The principal difference, I would say, is in the provision of fast broadband, that sort of broadband which is fibre optic based, 24 megabits per second and upwards. The Tories say that they basically would not subsidise it. They wouldn't have the BT landline tax of £6 a year, and that they'd sort of hope that the market would sort of build it out to the remote areas, whereas the Labour Party says that it would use this money and that it would subsidise the building of faster broadband, fibre optic broadband, in rural areas.
I'd like to reach out to you guys. Does anybody here live in a rural area?
I do.
I mean, how important is super fast broadband to you?
Well, we get 6 megabits at the moment, and that does us fine. I guess it's only going to be important when we start streaming video and TV shows and all that sort of thing down there.
Can I ask where you live? I mean, where is it? What rural area is it?
And I live on the Staffordshire Shropshire border.
Becky, you also live in a rural area.
Yeah, but about 20 metres from the Exchange, which is great.
Did you do that on purpose?
I did, pretty much. I mean, yeah. But there is an issue where I live around the business parks, because there are a bunch of business parks around where I live that are in the middle of nowhere. And the internet service is good, but often the SMEs that are in those business parks have to buy from the business park's central provider with a bunch of other services. And that's a net neutrality issue. They're buying services they don't want because they need the super fast broadband to do their business. So it's kind of a subtle issue, but our local MP asked us about it, and that was what we went back with them, saying that that was actually raising problems for a lot of people that we knew.
It's interesting that both the main parties are positioning super fast broadband, you know, fibre optic broadband, and access to government data as important things to be mentioning ahead of the election. I think that's intriguing in itself.
Moving on, Google announced last week that it will shut down its service in the Chinese mainland, moving everything to Hong Kong, which means that they've stopped self-censoring the service, although the government's filtering system may still prevent mainland users from seeing the results of many of their most sensitive services. this was a decision that was made after quite a protracted cat and mouse battle that we've been following on the podcast for quite a long time between the company and the country. Now, Becky, can you give us a quick overview of the situation?
Sure. So Google went into China with its Google.cn service in 2006. And at the time, there was a big public outcry because people had associated Google with its slogan, Don't Be Evil. And there was a lot of dissonance around that slogan and then going into a country with such a human rights record, particularly around the circulation of information. To its credit, Google said, there's a difference with our service. People know they're being censored. But I ended up interpreting it, as did, I think, a lot of others, as a purely commercial move. So in January this year, Google announced it was pulling its Google.cn servers. And just last week, we saw that they moved all of their operations to Hong Kong. Now, if you want to go with the interpretation of it being a commercial move, I think this was a commercial move as well. Google didn't really penetrate the Chinese market when you look at its competitor Baidu, and actually pulling out on a censorship ticket meant it could win commercially around the rest of the world.
Has anybody here tried to use the web in China? It looks yes.
Yes, some days, for example, when I was in China, the BBC site would stop to resolve. You just couldn't get to it. And then the next day or later in that day, it would resolve again. There's no announcements. There's no page that appears that says, sorry, we're blocking this site. It just does not resolve on the internet. And that happens constantly. I had a lot of work colleagues that were based in China and constantly had these stories that were there from both the UK and the US. There were expats in that part of the world. And they were constantly blocked from certain sites.
We are going to come to this subject in greater detail in just a second, but you can read up on all these stories and keep up to date with the latest technology headlines throughout the week on guardian.co.uk/technology. In the summer of 2009, Iran went to the election booths and cast its votes for the country's new leader. The world watched with increasing interest as the results came in because, as my guest Austin Heap told me during an interview with the Observer Review last week, things started looking weird. Quickly, concern was raised by voters and independent observers who claimed that the election was rigged. The outcome, the re-election of the incumbent Dr. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, stimulated bloody protests on the streets and on the web as opposition leaders and everyday Iranians challenged the results and clashed with the Iranian military. In addition to sending in the guns, the Iranian government tightened its already iron grip on the nation's media, including its internet access. They increased their list of websites on their blacklist, including social networking services like Facebook and like Twitter, and upped their filters on web services like Skype and Gmail. The result was that information about the protests was exponentially curtailed from flowing out of the country. The world, suddenly cut off from the activity on the ground, held its breath. However, the web sits on top of an unbreakable piece of technology, the internet. It's an infrastructure of, well, to coin a phrase, tubes and pipes, routers and switches, and it makes it virtually impossible to shut down any pathways of information. And that little fact is what galvanized a population of hackers, including Austin Heap of the Censorship Research Center, to crack open the Iranian internet and let the words of the protesters disseminate across the world. So, Austin, how is it possible for a government to censor the web?
It's possible to get part of the way there. Is it possible to completely censor the web? No. There will always be tools like Freegate, Tor, Haystack, that will make it much more difficult for them to get around, you know, any type of real censorship. If you're committed to hiding something in an email, you can hide it.
How did you do it specifically? What was your technology?
Well, I think what you have to do, because every single country has developed their own, you know, tech methods for filtering or suppressing dialogue, you have to look at how they're, you know, from a tech standpoint, how they're doing it. The way that Iran does it is very different from the way Cuba, for instance, does it. And so when we realized our basic, you know, let's provide as many proxies as possible for people in Iran wasn't going to work, we, you know, sat down, did a lot of analysis on, how, like from a tech standpoint, you know, what systems are in place, what operating system is doing the filtering, what software is this, where did this come from, and what is its limitations. That's the most important thing, and that's where the whole haystack concept came from, is figure out what their limitation is and then just go one step past that. And I think that's possible for every single country. There's always going to be a limit as to the, you know, the technical ability of people to censor things.
What effect would you say that Haystack had on how information left Iran after it was, because it found its way onto Iranians' computers?
Part of the way our network is designed is we provide everyone with the same level of security, of anonymity. And so it's not possible for us to look at the data, partially for our own protection, and figure out what's actually going on. But all of the sudden, you know, friends of mine were able to communicate again on Skype. You know, they can, there's a very prolific person on Twitter who was able to get back online and continue to provide information. A lot of people are familiar with, like, the Xbox gaming platform where it gives you that, like, you know, you can chat with people in real time. We were able to push, like, the Xbox communications over Haystack. And so all of a sudden, from the regime standpoint, it's not possible to tell what people are doing online, who they're talking to. It doesn't look like encrypted data.
Becky, we talked a little bit about ideologies before when we were talking about online privacy and this idea of what's private to one person may not be private to another person. Well, I think that, you know, if you look at censorship, online censorship as a big issue, as something that's on this continuum, there are people who would argue that online censorship actually isn't so bad after all. Is it not an ideological issue?
Well, is the internet an environment that we should see as a public space, a space where speech needs to be protected because that's going to have a net benefit to society? Or is it this commercial space, this contingent space, this space where, you know, actually we need to watch ourselves? And my answer to that would be definitely the former. I mean, just looking at, you know, a place like Iran where you don't see a lot of alternative media and the way that citizen journalism has, you know, rose to plug that gap, you can't really turn your back on this technology as a kind of machine for free speech or a machine to kill fascism.
It would be great if you could block people who were really out to, you know, do damage to, you know, random people who were out to hurt human rights, who were out to, you know, traffic underage people or do drug smuggling or, you know, there are, I mean, so many things that it would be great if there was a way to censor, but there is no easy way. And I think that when it comes to the online, you know, it's a digital meeting space. Like, this is 21st century, you know, public speech. Like, this is the First Amendment applied online. And I know that I'm saying that completely from a stateside standpoint, but I think it's something that we need to protect.
Charles, what do you think is the responsibility of developers who are creating these things for the potential badness that could be done under the cloaks of things like Haystack or even things like Tor?
It's like any technology. You know, all technologies are neutral. It's only about how they get used. It's really difficult. I mean, if developers were to sort of stop and say to themselves, oh, no, wait a minute, what are the potential bad uses for this? You know, how can I stop bad people using this? You know, shall I build in filters that can stop bad people doing these things? Then possibly a lot of stuff just wouldn't get done. You know, Microsoft would never have bothered to do Notepad or Word because you can write you know, Mein Kampf with it. But the wider question of online censorship is a really difficult one, because if we were sitting in China today, then we'd sort of think that actually, you know, censoring these search results about Tiananmen Square 1989, that's a really sensible thing to do, because that's all about social cohesion. It means that people are happy, that people understand where they are, that, you know, that they recognize that China is an incredible financial power which actually owns most of the United States debt. And that, you know, the United States being able to search for Tiananmen Square 1989 actually hasn't benefited it too much. You know, it had a huge housing bubble. All its banks went bust. Why is that good? There's no absolutely objective, you know, you can't be a Wikipedian and sort of say, actually, we're going to do a neutral point of view on censorship. Because there isn't. It completely depends where you stand.
We asked the audience what it was that they thought might be regulated. You know, because Austin, we talked about this the other day, and it's very difficult to draw that line in the sand to say, right, this is okay and this isn't okay. Some of the things that came back child porn and Google Street View should be banned, and that was Charlie Flowers. Charlie, where are you? Tell us why you think those things should be you know, regulated in some way.
The first one should be obvious. The second one...
No, don't make that assumption. Explain it.
Child pornography?
Yes, go on.
It's illegal.
Yes,
it's
why
wrong.
Is it illegal?
It's exploiting underage children. Okay. It's pernicious. It's corrosive. It gets people into trouble. It infects the internet. It paralyzes systems. What annoys me is we probably know where it's hosted on certain servers in Bulgaria and Russia and God knows where. Why we don't do something about it, I do not know. That was my first point. Sorry if that's an emotional standpoint.
That's fine.
The Google Street View one was a little less serious.
Can I just say I love the juxtaposition? Child pornography and Google Street View. I mean, it's brilliant. But I wonder if you wrote that down with any knowledge of how child sex abuse imagery is regulated online at the moment in this country, because there are regulatory systems in place.
And still it gets through.
Well, it's based on URL blocking, right? So when a new URL comes up, it needs to be kind of cited before it's put on a block list.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The other aspect, sorry, of course, is that certain service providers say, oh, it's nothing to do with us. How could we possibly monitor all this stuff that's going through our central hub?
If you want to hide data online, it's easy to hide. Like, you can hide it in anything. If child pedophiles or child pornographers want to move this data around, they're going to be able to do it just as easy as the people who steal music, the people who pirate movies when they're fresh out of the studio and just hit the theaters. I mean, it's relatively easy to hide any one and zero wherever you want online. And there's, I don't want to say never, but at least from where I stand, there's not going to be a piece of software that any government, any agency that's in a position to filter can, you know, develop an algorithm that can identify that this is abuse of a child, that this JPEG is something that, and I totally agree with you from like a moral standpoint, but from a tech standpoint, it's not possible. We can come up with these laws, we can prosecute these people, but there is no software that will end this.
But would it help if the government, say, banned encryption? Because, I mean, no, seriously, because back in the 90s, they were literally talking about doing that. I mean, I'm really interested in what you say, you know, the internet interprets censorship and roots around it. Yeah, we all believe that the technology can completely combat any kind of censorship mechanism. But back in the 90s, the US government and the UK government were talking about making encryption illegal for this very reason.
Right, and there was even the whole ban on exporting PlayStations.
Right,
I mean,
yeah.
Because they were afraid that the chips inside of those systems could be used to, you know, drive missiles in certain directions. If you're going to ban encryption, then ban online banking.
Yeah, no, I know the arguments against banning encryption, but what I'm asking you is, you know, if you banned on encryption, then there wouldn't be any more pedophiles, right?
I think no. There will always be pedophiles. They will always find a way to exploit people. The internet is just a way for them to do it faster.
I know that this is your first trip out of the U.S., and we're speaking about different perspectives here. We're speaking about, you know, the relationship between what one views is okay and what one views is not okay. I've been watching your tweets, and some of them are quite horrified. For example, you were surprised and shocked that you were stopped from taking photographs.
Not just stopped, it gets much worse.
Well, can you tell us actually what it is, how you think it compares with the U.S. in terms of specifically the British web compared with the U.S. web?
I honestly have been kind of surprised. First off, how aggressive American companies are at filtering their intellectual property content. When it comes to being here, it's been very nice to have iPlayer legally. But I think that there's such a legal threat against citizen journalism here. You cannot, like, if there's something going on in the States, I can walk outside with my iPhone, I can take a picture, I can post it online. What's in public is public. And there's no questions about that. But just the online censorship, the restrictions as to, you know, even when you go from like Wi-Fi hotspot to Wi-Fi hotspot, what they filter is completely arbitrary and rather easy to get around. But I would say the bigger threat besides the online issue is, you know, the laws that really prevent citizen journalists from existing.
Now, just to wrap up, I thought that there were some really good suggestions for the panel who would decide who would regulate the stuff on the web. We asked our audience who they thought should be on a panel to say yay or nay. This should be online and this should not be online. Charlie Flowers over there believes that Liberty campaigner Shami Chakrabarty should be on the panel. An anonymous person suggested young people should be on the panel, and that's quite an interesting suggestion. Jane, somewhere out there, suggested that there would be an elected body with academic consultation. And Tomba18 says people from security organizations and representatives of the public. And my favorite came from Brian O'Farrell, who said that Dimbleby, Paxton, and Stephen Fry should be on the panel. And so with that, I'd like to thank Austin very much for your participation. And you can find out more about the Censorship Research Center at censorshipresearch.org. And that's it for this week and our experiment into live audience podcasting. How did we do?
Hey!
Before we go, I have to thank the Dana Center staff who've been awesome throughout this, including Tobin May and Guyton Lee, who've helped realize this crazy dream of ours and who've been along for the ride for the other events in the series here at the Dana Center. Many thanks to our guests, Austin Heap, Christina Zaba, and to our Guardian Pod team, Becky Hogg, and Charles Arthur. The biggest thank you has to go to you guys, however. Thank you, thank you, thank you very much. It's been a lovely, although warm and long event. I think we've had a lot of really good debates up here, and we're definitely going to be doing it again. Thank you for coming along. Give yourself a round of applause. The podcast today was produced by Ewan and by Scott. I'm Alex Krotowski, and we'll be back next Tuesday. Thank you very much for joining us.